tragic situation here. Because of the boring nature of these presentations, we're going to have to move directly to lunch. No, just kidding. I'm sure the problem is going to be how we pack in all of the questions and comments that the people have. So let's have those hands go up, and we will start the process off. And if there are no hands, then I'm going to leap in. So that's a threat. There we go. Hand number one. And if you can, just identify who you are. I know, David, you have already, but just as a general rule, it's a good one.
David Sobel, Government of Ontario, and I want to mention that my comments may not necessarily reflect the position of the Government of Ontario. Kernahan, you know that I've written about Uber and I got into a certain amount of trouble about it. Just a couple of questions from the perspective of the regulator. So Uber needs roads to operate, and roads are paid for through tax revenue and by higher-priced commercial licenses. And if Uber needs roads to operate, what happens to the financing model of building roads and maintaining roads if everyone's using Uber and there are no more commercial licenses? That's the first question from the regulator's perspective. The second question is, does Uber reinforce the dependency on the individual car with two drivers in the car, which is better than one? But how does it undermine, if at all, a public transportation model, which is more efficient and I think a better utilization of resources, rather than using roads, even if they're electric cars, because that raises all kinds of questions about energy that is necessary to power the car, which can take an enormous amount of energy. So those are the kinds of questions as a regulator that I'm asking, because although I do agree that it's improved utilization, I think it creates other kinds of problems that we need to think about. It's not a long-term solution.
So just to address your first point, what I saw, there was a policy effect of telling people that up to $30,000, you don't have to claim GST. So you have, Uber is paying revenues on their money that they're taking as a business corporate tax. But when you talk about the independent contractors who are driving less than 10 hours or less than 5 hours, if you want to change the public policy of where the threshold is of where the GST remittance is, you can, but know that some of these people are driving as income bridging. So I've had a few seasonal workers as drivers, contractors who fell on hard times or there was something else going on. Would they perhaps collect EI or do something differently if they weren't doing this? It is an interesting sort of analysis that you could probably go through. I think that you've never had a better chance to actually have the data behind credit card transactions, which they all are. There's no cash. And interestingly, one of my very first conversations with a sort of a government group that we had talked about Uber and the sharing economy was, it was called the Gray Market Economy Forum. And I said, if you're going to tell all of these drivers that they are being suspected of operating quasi-illegally, I mean, how motivated are they to filing their taxes, and are you going to come after them for something else? I work for PwC, so I felt quite strongly that I was going to be the very first Uber driver to file my taxes. But even then, I had trouble navigating CRA and figuring out what do I qualify my income under. I am under other ground transportation. So you're not going to necessarily get an accurate picture from last taxation year yet on that. So I think those taxes should be paid for. I think there's other ways that you can actually grow the economy using these services. There's some anecdotal evidence that San Francisco, with their three or four competing ride-sharing companies, has actually grown the use of restaurants and other entertainment because there are things like a $5 Lyft line, which is a carpool. So people will go from one side of San Francisco to the other for $5. And at that point, you don't have an excuse to tell your friend that you're staying in and watching Netflix. You're going out to dinner more often. You're doing more things in the city. And they've actually had some correlations to those two things. And then quickly on your second question, which I think was on the use of public transport versus some of these ride-sharing services. So I think the last mile problem is the one I'm actually more interested in. I think you're right that, for me taking, down the Yonge Line, if I follow that same route instead of taking the TTC, it doesn't make much sense. But if I think about Go Commuters, which is our suburban transit. The Oakville station in for GO, for instance, is hugely overloaded. They think that based on projections, they're going to need another, I don't know, 15,000 parking spots or something crazy like that. So if you think about the last mile problem of how do people get to and from these stations, and rather than sort of building out that whole network, could it be complementary? And I think that's probably a good place to move the discussion.
They're great presentations. Maybe I'll turn a question to Sunil, that's probably really for both of you. From a sort of public policy perspective, it's a very interesting challenge because it's a global challenge, right? There's a sense in which you're looking at all of these different jurisdictions, and they all seem to be trying to reinvent the wheel, and yet they're basically struggling with the same problems. And I guess how much you've thought about that and how much, say, the importance of something like the OECD to take kind of leadership, you know, in the context of things like privacy, regulation, whatever, the OECD did take a lead 35 years ago, and a lot of countries followed their lead. So I'm sort of curious to know how much of that is actually happening or how much sort of potential there is.
I think that's an excellent question. I mean, we're seeing it even in Ontario or within different parts of Canada where different cities are taking different approaches or they're all reviewing their taxi licensing regimes at the same time. It kind of would logically more make sense if they just combined their resources and said, let's figure out something that works for everybody. Like driving a cab isn't fundamentally that different in Ottawa or Toronto or London, Ontario. So I do think there is a role for places like the OECD or national level governments to step in a little bit more and say, maybe not you have to do this, but here might be a smart way of doing this, so kind of like a default legislation or default approach. I mean, there's a private members bill in Ontario introduced by Tim Hudak to regulate the sharing economy, which does many of those same things. So it's basically, if municipalities don't regulate this, here are the rules around Airbnb and Uber and companies like that. But if they want to kind of supplement or amend that type, that standard, they could. But these are complex challenges because they're both short and long-term implications. So things like competition within a certain sector are very hard for us to ascertain right now. But in 5 years, we could be in a situation theoretically where Uber's the only game in town, and you could very certainly see a scenario under that type of circumstance where Uber starts raising the amount of commission they take from their drivers and is maybe not such a friendly partner for the drivers if they're the only game in town. So I think it's challenging for governments to think about things that move quickly, and it's also challenging to think about things that have short and long-term implications across a whole different range of policy realms. And that's exactly what this policy challenge presents, so that's why governments are having such a big problem with it.
Yeah, I've seen two people, Bob and then Michael, if you can identify yourselves before you speak. And as I'm going across, I'm just going to get in a little dig here. We probably all heard that expression, the unions, the people who brought you the weekend, right? Well, I'm just wondering whether or not we can say, with respect to Uber, the people who brought reform to the taxi. Because suddenly we're seeing taxi companies that are, in fact, using apps and so on. I wonder how quickly they would have been with those apps were it not for Uber basically breaking down the front door.
In the focus that I use, which is incentives. And I worry about, in terms of the wonderful presentations that we've heard, that the tax system dropped on people through lobbying and lots of reasons. And there's some holes in it. And your presentations look to me like the service area would be one where there's a whole lot of incentives to avoid taxation that can give you a whole lot new economic activity. You might not even want it. Secondly, though, and the incentives are related to trust, and you were mentioning this, Ted, you probably know that there are some firms that will plant false messages on rating systems. So the restaurant gets some bad ratings. You can go to a firm, they'll plant some on there. And then no longer can the customer understand the ratings because it doesn't take too many wrong ones to mess up the good ones. And in that regard, Canada, I think, is something of a leader because there was the penalty that Bell agreed to. over $1 million, $1.25 million, for planting false messages on competitors' sites. So that's a rule we have against astroturfing, which is covering over the mess with some grass. But so I would wonder if the attention that you're devoting to this, and you raise the issue of trust, doesn't need a little more sort of general treatment, so that instead of trying to deal with trust here and trust there and trust there, we have some sort of overarching rules that would be like truth in advertising or transparency or something like that.
Just so everybody knows, there is going to be a session right after lunch on social media and information and online consumer reviews and all kinds of things like that. So this issue will be dealt with then, but I guess, Sunil, at first instance, the question was directed at you.
Sure. So I think it's an excellent point, because I don't think we can just, as policymakers or researchers, just say, well, we can trust Uber, and whatever their rating system says is 100% accurate, because there are very strong incentives for them to game the system potentially. So I think the governments need to take an active role. So if City of Boston is entering into a data sharing agreement with Uber, they need to have a great deal of assurance that the data they're getting is actually the real data and Uber's not kind of holding back information. There are very strong penalties in place that if they are messing around with the data, that they're going to get fined heavily or otherwise sanctioned. So I absolutely think that's an approach. I mean, the UK has started moving forward with kind of like a, as you call it, kind of like a industry code of certification for sharing economy companies that meet certain kinds of criteria. So to kind of give a little bit more assurance that this is a company that meets certain levels of standards in terms of how it operates, I think that's something that you'll see. So kind of like more informal industry-led things, I think there is a role for government to fill those gaps as well. I certainly am not one to say that self-regulation. I own a Volkswagen and an Audi, so self-regulation did not work well for me, so I was burned by that already.
That there is a big incentive for Uber to game the system here. You know, if you're sort of riding on trust from the community, that would be a really big brand hit to play if that was sort of discovered. When I think about where government can play in terms of auditing actual ratings, I think that there is a strong role of doing, whether it's sampling. You know, if we look at the Yelp examples where people were creating false reviews of other restaurants, there was lots of ways that people could go in and do that, as opposed to some of these closed systems where you after your trip can enter a rating, but it's not like you go on an anonymous website and you enter in a rating that way. For Uber, at least, same thing for Airbnb. So this idea of an audited or verified rating system where the government or a regulator can play a part in sort of auditing that, I think, makes sense. I also think so because, in part, I think you're going to start seeing portability of ratings, so that imagine a new credit score of the future where people can take, you know, there's something called Open Table, which is you make reservations, and if you don't show up for those reservations, and, you know, maybe you are a really poor Uber passenger, and if I'm an Airbnb host, would I want to give a preferential rating for somebody who had a better sharing economy social score than somebody else? And in that case, you would certainly want those to be audited in some way and verified. And I don't think we're actually too far off that.
Michael, now?
This is Michael Jenkin. I used to be a bureaucrat in the consumer areas. Now I'm no longer retired. One thing that really rang, I don't know if alarm bells, but certainly really stuck out for me in both of the presentations, because both of you mentioned it, was the issue of network effects. And you talked a little bit about it a moment ago, but there seems to be an inexorable linkage between what is distinctively beneficial about this stuff, which is the trust sharing and the information sharing and the information, the ability for both the buyer and the seller to access information, number one, and that linkage being strengthened by it being delivered through a network. And of course, we all know about network effects, which is that, you know, industries which become get real efficiencies to their benefits through network effects very quickly devolved to oligopoly or monopoly. Okay, so the question is here, I guess, the thinking about how do we manage this conundrum, because we're trying to capture both the upside of this, which you know is obvious, but also I think we're maybe seeing a downside here, which is the impact on competitive activity, and we all know what happens with oligopolies, which is regulatory capture, you know, all of that stuff that goes on with manipulating the system that becomes very sophisticated and very difficult to get a hold on through traditional political processes. So anyway, I'd be interested in your comments on that as observers of this process.
And these so would be while, the last comments to be had. Yeah.
So while the mic is traveling up, I'll jump in. You know, I would question the premise of the sort of network effect automatically leads to oligopoly. You know, there is a website out there that allows friends to connect and share photos. And how many of you are on Friendster? Friendster? Anybody know Friendster?
No.
Dominant networking platform in the mid-90s, replaced by MySpace. How many people on MySpace? So the switching cost, the switching cost from these networks are very low still. So we're talking about taking off an app, putting on an app on phones, as opposed to, you know, copper wire into our homes, right? So these are the digital and physical world. You really need to be able to compare these things and where it's maybe going to go or not go.
I agree. To some extent, I agree with that. Like, these aren't very sticky platforms. Like, it's very easy for me to download a new app if Uber is no longer meeting my needs, but I do agree with you as well that we're kind of in the ascendancy of these platforms now, so they are being good citizens. There isn't really the kind of risk, but if we do reach a point where Uber is the only game in town or Airbnb is the only way I can stay anywhere in the world, I mean, that's kind of an extreme scenario. There are risks there, and I don't know if there's a good answer to that. It's really difficult for competition authorities to step in and stop something like that. I mean, Google's facing a lot of these same issues in Europe. It's starting to happen in North America. As well, I don't really think there's a good answer. I think it's kind of it's a new problem because of it's a technology problem and it's a competition problem, and it's kind of it's hard to regulate against what people want to do. It's more just where's the downside, and when people are getting harmed by the monopolistic position of some of these firms, how do we make sure there are protections in place and that we're making sure they are not being exploited? And I think I don't know if there's a good regulatory regime that captures all of those issues right now.
Okay, just a final thought here is I just wonder whether or not on the consumer side and on the public interest side, we hear constantly every day in the newspaper about you know the position of Uber on this and the position of the taxi industry on this and the position of the taxi regulators on this. That is well heard every day in the newspapers, but we're not really hearing particularly where the consumers are at this, other than by a survey or the public. And I think this speaks to consumer organizations, because consumer organizations are potentially the voice of consumers. And it would be very interesting to have, when I see these debates, it would be very interesting to see consumer organizations standing up and saying, well, this is where we're at. We want this, this, and this, and we're, you know, what we're concerned about is this, this, and this, because it's a missing part of the debate, other than proxies like government standing in and saying, this is where the public is at on this, and this is where consumers are at on it. Anyway, we'll stop for lunch. Fantastic, fantastic presentations. Thank you very much. Carmen has a small public announcement to make, or maybe Geneviève has. Yes?
Well, it's just what you said, lunch across the hall. We can use this room, and we'll reconvene at 1 o'clock.
There we go. Thank you very much. Great job.
Thanks, Carmen.
Great job.